Hey everybody, Patrick Connor here, and welcome to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. Boxing history time again. We're talking anniversaries also again. I mean, I guess it just goes to show how much inspiration we take from current events, that not as much is going on, and so we're just kind of relying on the history. But that means I'm here with my dude Arispina, CompuBox operator and fellow fight history fanatic like myself. What up, dude? How are you?
How's everything, my man?
Doing all right, man. I'm always excited to talk history with you. I'm always excited to go over shit that, you know, especially this era from the 1970s, like late 70s, early 80s, is really fun. And that's what we're doing today, man.
Absolutely. And today, you know, the card that we're profiling is one of the marquee ones of boxing history for a variety of reasons. You know, the players involved in it, the results of the fights, and like you said, man, the time, place of it. Of, you know, what would happen subsequently with their careers afterwards and everything like that. So what we're talking about happened today, November 30th, 1979. It was a date of an astounding, outstanding doubleheader promoted by Top Rank, which is Wilfred Benitez, undefeated, but the boy wonder defending his welterweight championship against 1976 Olympic gold medalist and darling 7-Up kid Sugar Ray Leonard, which in itself is a huge event as a fight. But hold up. Not only that, on the undercard, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, for years being called the uncrowned champion and deserving of a title shot, was finally going to get his chance against the really rough and rugged Beto Interfermo. Couldn't get any better for a doubleheader.
I mean, just those four names, well, not even those four, just like one or two of those names is an entire podcast easily. Mm-hmm. But we're going to try to condense the entire event into this one. It was 43 years ago. Today on 1979, November 30th, 1979. So just to underscore the importance of this event, but also how much things have changed, how different things are in terms of how boxing's received, the coverage, etc., and the broadcasts. This was on a Friday. It was on ABC. It wasn't some massive pay-per-view like you would expect today. So it was totally accessible to a lot of fans. And yeah, I mean, just that alone is pretty crazy. The fact that it happened the way that it happened. And I mean, massive event, dude. Huge event. And obviously also a portent of things to come, for sure.
And the fact, again, man, this to show you again the time period when this took place. This took place on ABC, on free television. Fights like this, fights like Ali Spinks 2, which almost the entire country watched live on just free television. It was a whole different time. A card like Benitez Leonard on its own would be a massive pay-per-view event today that would charge you like between $75 to $80 for a pay-per-view to watch that. Or if you're going to be ringside for that, thousands of dollars for a ringside ticket. It would have everybody on boxing Twitter salivating, rightfully so. And then you add Marvelous Marvin Hagler fighting Vito Interfermo, finally getting his title shot against Vito Interfermo as the main undercard attraction of that fight. That right there. In today's, they wouldn't even be a whole card, because they would, the promoters would justify that Hagler and Interfermo could be its own main event, which it could have been anywhere else. You know, the fact that they put it with Benitez Leonard makes it even more of a special event, because both of those cards on their own, just their one fight holds weight to be their own main event, especially, you know, Benitez Leonard. But like, Hagler and Interfermo was a big fight in itself. That was a fight that everybody was clamoring for. Hagler was finally, after years of neglect and all kinds of shit that he was going through, was finally going to get, you know, the chance to become champion. And most people felt it was going to be his rightful coronation. Interfermo was another guy that rough and rugged came through the trenches of the middleweight scene of the 70s, which was really dreadful to go through. Finally became champion in late 78, beating Hugo Coro and shit. Like, everybody knew that was going to be an absolute banger. But you know, just to have them together just made that so much more special. So it's almost unfathomable today, 43 years later, Pat, like you said, to have that type of card actually happening. You know what I mean? But back in 1979, boxing was in a different place and they're able to do something like that.
Yeah, dude, it's, I guess, working our way toward the main event, we'll start with kind of Hagler and Interfermo. Why not? Mm-hmm. It's Marvelous Marvin. He also recently, unfortunately, passed away. So that's still kind of raw, I think, for a lot of people, especially because of the return to the International Boxing Hall of Fame this past year. And he was a big feature every year at the Hall of Fame. This was kind of the first year without him and without several other fighters who had passed away in the meanwhile, too. But you know, I guess it's just important to remember, rewinding a little bit in Marvin Hagler's history and U.S. history too, and I'll try to condense it as much as I can so I don't go off in the weeds too much. But Marvin Hagler, even though he fought out of Massachusetts and was massive around Brockton and whatnot, just like Marciano, came from Newark, New Jersey. Yeah. And a fairly important thing to remember, just to kind of explain who Marvin Hagler was, how he thought, why he acted the way he acted, and how paranoid he was and how pissed off and frustrated he was throughout his boxing career. I mean, I'm not saying that this is the reason for it. I'm saying that if you take this into account, you, I think, can understand a bit more. Back in Newark in the 1960s, late 1960s, during the civil rights movement, in the summer of 1967, there were riots around the U.S., like all around the U.S. in just about any major city, and especially in the on the West Coast. Philadelphia, Newark, New York had a number of riots. And in Newark, it was like its own thing. It was really bad, really, really bad. Obviously stemming from a lot of racial and social injustice and inequality. But also a couple of inciting incidents, kind of like the George Floyd protests in 2020. Mm-hmm. In any case, how that involves Marvin Hagler was that his family home, he said that his mom hid them, he and his siblings, in their home during the riots for like 3 days. And then their home was eventually destroyed, and or at least damaged really badly. And so they moved from Newark to Massachusetts. And so basically that, I think, was really formative in terms of Marvin Hagler's distrust for a lot of people, especially distrust for, I mean, dude, just fucking putting it plainly, white authority.
Yes, I was about to bring that up. Good point, Pat.
I mean, just fucking putting it plainly, that's just how I think he felt for a lot of his career. And this also, this Antuofermo fight buildup, the fucking result, you know, everything just fueled it, just fueled it.
So, like you said, Hagler moves to Brockton, and like, you know, coming from the Newark riots and the things that were things that were going down with the country. And with the riots and the tension, everything, it was, you know, America was definitely like in a hot pot at that point. And Hagler being a kid and witnessing all of this stuff as a child and being traumatized by that certainly didn't help him when he moves to Brockton, Massachusetts, which I'm from Massachusetts. All right. So I can even relate to this. It's like a whole different world from Newark. Sure, there's parts out there. It's really bad. There's other things like that. You can relate to it in certain ways, but in terms of just, you know, the population and the way things are out there, it's different. And Hagler was in a world, like you said, now he's, instead of where he was in Newark, now he's in Brockton, where certain parts is a lot of, you know, Italian Americans, Irish Americans, Portuguese, this and that. No one really like him. And the way he gets in the boxing, more or less, is that at one point, you know, as a teenager, he goes to a party. I think you can help me corroborate this. And gets into an argument with another guy that ends up becoming a fighter himself named Darnell Wingfall, who was a bully around the neighborhood and just an overall tough guy. And I think they were arguing over a woman or something for the matter, but Hagler and Wingfall go outside for a fight and Wingfall beat him up. And, you know, everybody witnessed this, everything like that. And Hagler was embarrassed. He was hurt, but he actually, you know, he got beat up and he said to himself, I'm never going to let this happen to me again. And he seeked out to go to a gym to go find out, you know, how to fight. So first gym he ends up at is a guy who, if you listen to the show, he's probably most known for working with Peter McNeely. And his name was Vinny Vecchione?
Vecchione, I would imagine, I don't know.
But that's the first gym from, you know, from George Kimball's Four Kings book and a couple other, you know, Hagler accounts. That's the first gym Hagler ended up at. It wasn't at the Petronelli gym. He wandered into Vinny Vecchione's gym. And like you just alluded to, Pat, Hagler having a distrust now of, you know, white people and authority and stuff like that. He didn't say anything when he went into that gym. You know, he just sat on the bench and just got really quiet and just kind of observed everything. It was kind of wasn't going to go out of his way to approach anyone. He was going to wait till someone kind of approached him. And then, you know, because he's just doing that. And he said that, In 3 days that he sat there, Vecchione, no one even came, no one yet looked in his direction, no one acknowledged him, no one nothing. So he eventually left there because just nothing, he felt nothing was going to happen. Probably for the best, because in years later, Vecchione literally was just known for working for Peter McNeely and that stupid farce that he had when the Tyson fight in the Pizza Hut commercial. That was it. There was literally nothing else he ever did of worth of note besides just training, you know, local guys in New England. So that was a blessing in disguise for Hagler. Now he ends up at the Petronelli gym, owned by Goody and was his brother Pat, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And over there, Hagler did the same thing. He didn't approach anyone, just kind of sat on the bench, just got really quiet and just, you know, observed. Finally, I think it was Goody approached him after like the second or third day and walked up to him and said, "Son, would you like to learn how to box?" Hagler looked at him and said, "I do. I want to." And he said, "Okay, you know," and the rest
it's
is
very,
kind of
it's a very passive aggressive way to fucking get a trainer, you know, just sitting there and like staring motherfuckers down until somebody's "So what are you doing? What are you?"
Because they're like that. I mean, hey, look, man, and you know, coming
from it worked.
Gyms like that, there were kids that used to come to the gym too that didn't talk. Like sometimes they would just go with a friend of theirs. I would watch them too as kids. We didn't know who they were they wouldn't know nothing. They were just kind of standing in the corner and observe. Whether they were shot or...
And I mean, not to interject too much, but it takes balls, dude. It takes guts to go into a boxing gym and to start, like, you know, not just go in there and kind of, you know, but to actually train. It takes fucking guts, man.
Because if you walk into a gym, especially when you're younger, you feel like all eyes are on you, and they are to a degree. When you walk in, you're a foreigner and you haven't been in there. And everybody knows each other in that gym. And all of a sudden you'd see
it's intimidating, you know, donk, 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 donk. You know, there's a bunch of noise and shit.
People,
it's crazy.
They're still glancing at you. All of a sudden they're hitting the head bad. They're kind of looking at you like, "Oh, who's that?" You know? And then you walk into the trainer and like, "Oh, is this going to be someone trying to join us?" Like it can be nerve wracking, but Hagler went up there, you know, explained who he was, yada, yada, yada. And they picked him up and, you know, the rest is history. He became a prodigy right away because he had a work ethic that no one had ever seen before. You know, early on, he told Petronelli, he was like, "Yeah, I'm going to be champion of the world one day." Petronelli, he was still a kid. So Petronelli just kind of like, you know, he's like an early teenager. Petronelli just kind of joked it off. He was like, "Yeah, that's great, kid." He was like, "When you become champion, I'll be your manager." And, you know, you couldn't write it any better than that.
They said that back in the day, he used to run. And that when he was running, like way back in the day, he used to mutter to himself, like, "I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill them all. Nobody can stop me. Nobody can stop me from killing him." And he'd just sit there muttering to himself, during his road work, because he had a one track mind as far as like what he wanted to do. And he was also a highly competent, if not very good amateur too. He wasn't just some guy. Sometimes that kind of seems to be the, you know, he's a street fighter. It's like, no, dude, he was a fucking boxer. He was very well schooled and he knew what he was doing in there. Even if he had a fairly, you know, kind of rough style or an aggressive physical style, but even so, the funny thing is when you like going into this fight and when I going into the Antuofermo fight. So, I mean, sorry, I don't want to fast forward too much because it's important, like what he went through to that point is important because Philadelphia in particular, the middleweight division during that time, it's like the very top wasn't super top heavy, but on that kind of like A- to like C+ level, bro, super fucking thick, real deep, super fucking deep. And Philadelphia in particular had a number of middleweights that were really, really good. A number of those East Coast cities had middleweights that were really good. And those were the fighters that Marvin Hagler had to go through in order to get that middleweight title shot. And even then, even fucking all the way back then, it was like overdue. You know, people were writing about Marvin Hagler and saying like, what is it going to take? Like, why is this guy not getting his title shot? And so, I mean, it's funny also because the way that he was written about was not like he was a power puncher or anything. That he was more written about like he was a boxer puncher with some emphasis on the boxer for sure. Like he wasn't known as like a destroyer.
Totally. And it should be noted, buddy, you know, it should be noted too that like, so when he turned pro in 1973 and he was just right after he won the national AAU championship. That's a big award, especially back then. That was a big, big tournament. It was right on par with the Golden Gloves and everything else. And that would put you on track to, you know, if you stayed as an amateur and you win more awards, like, that would put you on track to eventual, you know, at least a shot at the Olympics. The thing with Hagler was that he was impatient. The 72 games had just passed. I don't think he was really ready to wait, you know, 3.5-4 years to for the next shot. And I remember he was quoted as saying too that, like, you know, trophies don't buy groceries or something to the effect of that. And so he turns pro, but with no fanfare, even though he wins the AU championship. It's obviously not the Olympic gold medalist and, you know, the past Olympics with Sugar Ray Seals winning it, everything that just passed. So Hagler's in a transition. He has to come up the hard way, not unlike, you know, not like guys like Sugar Ray Leonard and Howard Davis, who were all, you know, guaranteed contracts with networks already and just going to be featured and making six-figure paydays from their pro debut. Hagler wasn't making shit. He turns pro at Brockton High School. Like, he had to, you know, crawl his way to the top even before he went to Philly, because there was already a bunch of roadblocks that were already thrown in his way too. You know what I mean? Like, he was beating a lot of the guys in the local New England scene, and he finally got a chance to avenge his street beatdown against the notorious Darnell Wingfall. And in a fight, in a battle with unbeatens, ended up beating him. And I think he beat him a couple of times. But already, you know, by the time he ends up fighting Sugar Ray Seals in 1974, Hagler is just a guy that's been on the New England scene. Like, he's not nationally known. He's undefeated, but people, you know, he's a guy that's just been hardened. Like you said, that's the dude that's just in his mind. All he wants to do is seek and destroy and try to make it to the top. And he's doing it the hard way. He hasn't been coddled and he hasn't been fed any cupcakes. And when he fights Seals in a TV studio, of all things, that, you know, I don't think the fight was ever filmed, because obviously the film would have been shown by now. But we've seen photos of it and it looks fascinating, right? It's like literally like a television studio.
Yeah. Like the curtains film. And all that type of shit. Yeah, it looks fucking funky.
It really does. Like, you're about to film like a TV show or something. And then you just see like a small audience around there. And there's Hagler and there's Sugar Ray Seals right there going at it.
And if I'm not mistaken, I believe that is the fight that Ray Seals later on, according to him, said that he was convinced that they were going to do some sort of exhibition.
Yes.
Or something to that effect, that it was not going to be like a, you know, full on whatever. And that he got there and that Hagler was like fucking raring to go. And he was like, oh, and I mean, I have no idea. That sounds kind of weird, but whatever. I mean, it's not impossible. But that being
Silverman, if Sam Silverman, the longtime New England, famous New England promoter, I think he was behind that fight, because I think he passed away a couple of years afterwards. If he was behind that, then he probably, I wouldn't put him past him to convince Seals that he was coming in for just an easy coddle, you know, whatever it may be.
Yeah, but I don't know, man. I mean, I'm, like I said, it's not impossible, but it just, it's kind of a weird story. But even so,
he beat Seals, right?
Who was the 1972 Olympic gold medalist. So it was almost kind of like, yeah, it was like making a point, you know, it was making a big point for him.
And he still couldn't catch a break after that. If anything, that made it even tougher for him, because people are now just like, whoa, who the fuck is this? He has no name. He has no money to attach to it. And like, it's just a big risk. And he just whooped up the Olympic gold medalist that people, you know, I don't think Seals had the same clamor that Leonard and everyone else did. But like, he was still a guy that people had a lot of promise in, you know what I mean? And he got cooked in that fight. So yep. It's like, you
know. And he was the next Sugar Ray before Ray Leonard was.
Yes, yeah, Sugar Ray Seals, exactly. So, again, man, it took years, it took for a while, the mid-70s, Hagler was still, when Carlos Munzon, people, you know, here's the thing too, Pat, right? People always say, oh, you know, Munzon could have fought Hagler, blah, blah, blah. No, not at all. Hagler was still going through the ranks at this point, fighting, he was fighting often and gaining a lot of experience, but by 1975, 76, he wasn't even considered even close to a title shot. If anything, people were still talking about him in hushed tones and being like, "Hey, man, should we even risk ourselves against a guy like this?"
Yeah, it was tough for him to even break into that Philadelphia scene by then.
Yes.
You know, that scene alone, that just that scene, not even, never mind the other places that were producing fighters, that scene alone was rough, man. And so even just breaking into that scene was tough, and he did, but he did it with a couple of tough losses that he wound up avenging, obviously. But that being said, it didn't come without, you know, paying a price, dude. He toiled on this circuit, basically. You know, he was running the gauntlet. That was the fucking gauntlet, was this pack of fucking middleweights here, dude.
And he was forced to go there.
And like you said, so Carlos Monzon retires. And by the time Carlos Monzon retired, it was because he was struggling in his last handful of fights. He was either getting buzzed, rocked, wobbled, you know, or having some sort of difficulty with whoever he was fighting. And they were pretty good fighters, too. It's not like he was struggling with scrubs. But I think that he realized that it was time to. And on top of that, coupled with like all of his legal issues and the destructive lifestyle he was leading, I think that he just knew it was time to go. He retires, and I think it was 1972. Rodrigo Valdez. 77. I'm sorry?
You said 72. You meant like 77, I think.
I might have. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I just had it up and I was looking at it. So apparently I didn't retain it very well. Yeah. Sorry. You're correct. So retired in 77, not 72. And then Rodrigo Valdez wound up winning the middleweight championship after that. Like you mentioned Hugo Coro. And basically that's kind of where Marvin Hagler's path intertwined with Vito Entuofermo, who, you know, also was from the East Coast, was also with an Italian team. It's not to say that like all East Coast Italians knew each other, but the boxing community is small. And so in any case, it was pondered that these two would eventually meet at some point a couple years before this. And then finally, it was in, of course, I navigated away, but in 1979 in Monaco. So by this time, like I said, Marvin Hagler's already run the gauntlet through the Philadelphia middleweights and gotten his vengeance where he needed it. And people have been calling for a middleweight championship shot for Marvin Hagler for a good year or two by now. And so the middleweight championship kind of getting passed around, or, you know, there's no firm leader.
It was a weird transition after that, after not to cut you off, but like after Monzon retired. It really was, because Monzon was that dominant champion for a long time. Actually, how we're going to relate this to the welterweights in a minute, but like with Jose Napoles, but like Monzon was the dominant champion for a long time at middleweight from the very beginning after he knocked out Nino Benvenuti. So he retires, and his nemesis for the past couple of years, Rodrigo Valdez, finally takes the throne. As we've talked about in past shows before, Valdez, who looked so formidable against other middleweights before then and against Monzon, you know, running him the gauntlet twice, and, you know, Benny Briscoe, yada, yada, yada. All of a sudden, he starts looking kind of mediocre when he becomes champion. Like, he's made a couple of defenses, but clearly the spark or whatever was pushing him when Monzon was still active is gone now. And when he loses to Hugo Coro, that's when the middleweight division is just kind of like in a flux where you just kind of, well, because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wasn't looking very dominant as a middleweight champion, Valdez, that is. And then when Hugo Coro beats him, I think it was kind of like a moment where people are like, well, where are we going to go from here? You know?
Exactly.
And so, but that also opened the door for Vito Entuofermo, who was ranked, I think, a little bit higher by the WBC than Hagler or something like that. So I don't know if it was a connections thing, probably, because it sounded like Top Rank was promoting Entuofermo at the time and stuff like that. But in any case, Entuofermo gets the shot at Hugo Coro, beats him. And then on top of that, on the undercard, Marvin Hagler is fighting Norberto Cabrera. But mm-hmm. the entire time, so during the promotion of this fight, like the idea of fights being taken to Monaco is a somewhat newer thing, or at least they're trying to hype up the pageantry. And we all know how this happens in various locales from the last few years. Macau, they did that shit for Macau for a couple of years. Whoa, you know, this is a brand new thing. We're doing this for years. And nothing ever happened. They've gone back to Monaco in recent years, but it doesn't happen often. Similarly, they're trying to build up the idea of fights happening in Monaco more. And when they were promoting this fight, supposedly the promotions for these fights in Monaco were super stiff. The fighters aren't supposed to talk. They're not promoting themselves. They just go through the motions and have the fights. And it's like this hoity-toity, everybody's having this fucking like $1,000 plate meal type of shit while fighters are fighting type of, you know, bullshit, and they're in tuxedos and whatnot. But during the promotion, Marvin Hagler, who's fighting on the undercard, spoke up and was like, basically, this is some bullshit. Like, I'm the one who's supposed to be getting the middleweight title shot. I don't know what the fuck is going on in the main event, but I'm going to tell you this, like, whoever is fighting, like, I'm a fight him next and blah, blah, blah. And I guess that caught everybody off guard, because the European folks who were covering this were not expecting it. And so Marvin Hagler making the noise and blah, 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 he's criticizing the main event where Antua Formero defeats Coro. And so that fight, the kind of the spark was lit for these two to finally meet. And on top of that, on top of Marvin Hagler deserving this shot against Antua Formero, he still took the short end of the stick by a lot to get the fight.
Absolutely. It's, you know, Antua Formero was one of those guys. He was from the New York area, really popular. He came up tough himself. He suffered a few losses early in his career, most notably because he had really, really bad scar tissue. Like, the guy, if you breathe on him, it's kind of like Arturo Gatti years later. If, like, you know, if you looked at him, just looking at him, he would start swelling up. And Antua Formero was different, not so much swelling, but he would just bleed. Like, if you breathe on him, he would get a nick on his eye. You know what I mean? And coming up through the scenes, he suffered losses to the likes of, like, Maurice Hope and, I believe, Howard Weston Jr. because of, you know, eye issues. But he was just a scrappy guy, another really tough dude from the division that, like, you know, had really good names on his ledger as well, like Emil Griffith and a few others. And probably, you know, a little bit more popular than Hagler was at that point. Even though Hagler was the guy that, like, consensus the uncrowned middleweight champion, Antua Formero had a following and was, and, you know, in terms of Aram, he probably easier to promote. And so that's why that fight was to be made. With Hagler being known that, hey, you would get the winner of this. So yeah, Hagler's pissed off because he felt like he wanted Coro and he wanted it right then and there. But, you know, the stage was set, like you said, for, you know, for Antua Formero in his first title fight, he had to fight a guy like Hagler. And that made it even bigger because Antua Formero was popular. He had a crowd-pleasing style, even though he was a mauler and a brawler. And Hagler was a guy that just fuming, been destroying everything in his path, righted the wrongs with the two losses that he had already had at this point, and had gone through everyone in the division at, like, you know, we've talked about, like, we talked about he had to go through Philly. We even talk about how Don King fucked him around when he tried to join the U.S. title tournament, well, the U.S. championship tournament, and Goody Petronelli and the rest of them were just like, yo, why can't Hagler join? How are you going to put the guys that Hagler has already knocked out in this tournament and you won't put Hagler in there? And Don King tells Hagler, listen, if you drop the Petronellis and sign with me, you can be in the tournament, everything will be good. And Hagler, showing his loyalty, said, I'm not doing that, and kind of screwed him in as well. So that was the thing. Hagler being loyal to his cornerman, to his, you know, his team, and doing everything, even brought more detriment to him trying to ascend the title, because that's just how boxing works. But at this point now, man, he's
well, ultimately, that was a good decision to not go into that fucking tournament.
Thank God. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And just in general with his career, because it just showed, like, you know, that type of loyalty that was very rare in boxing. But Bob Arum took a chance with Hagler. You know, you got to give it to him for that. He got in business with the Petronellis. They didn't try to push him out on that, and figured to himself, too, I can make money. And either way, I got Antua Formero, I got Hagler. Some way I'm going to be controlling the middleweight championship. So that's how the stage was set.
Yeah, and it makes sense, too, that I think that this was probably a bit of a hardcore matchup at the time in terms of interest, because neither of them were super popular. But it was two guys who were just going to throw down. You know, like, it was two fighters who were coming to fight no matter what. You knew how Vito Antua Formero was going to fight. He was going to bore in. He wound up getting that scar tissue. Also, he was on The Sopranos, too. I forgot about that shit until I was watching that shit the other night, and I was like, isn't that it is Vito
Formero. It was. That wasn't it. Yeah,
dude, I totally forgot he was on that show. I was watching the other night. But in any case, yeah, dude, he bore in with his head. He had real bad scar tissue because he was always getting cut, like in his eyebrows and stuff like that. And he was going to throw. He wasn't a big puncher, but he was going to throw for sure. And so Hagler being Hagler, also being the kind of guy who was not usually big on taking a backward step, but could definitely, but usually wanted to push the fight. I think a lot of people knew that this was bound to be a good action fight. And so, I mean, yeah, I think that it was. And I think that it wound up being a pretty good fight from an entertainment standpoint, especially in the later rounds as Hagler started to kind of slow down. Yes. But yeah, I mean, like this, well, I mean, I don't want to like, you know, try to like hold out like there's some sort of fucking suspense. Like a lot of people know that this fight ended in a draw. And it was a fairly unceremonious draw. A lot of people thought that it was fairly controversial at the time, and it was written about controversially. Dude, I mean, I'm assuming you thought Hagler won pretty firmly as well.
Yeah, like I've watched it a few times, and I'm not gonna like. It's actually a little bit close. I thought it was a little bit closer than like it wasn't out and out like Hagler won fucking 12.
It wasn't like the worst robbery I've ever seen.
No. But Hagler, I thought, definitely won the fight and won it by a couple of points to spare. Absolutely. Like, he was out. But the thing is, what happened was that Hagler didn't go toe-to-toe with Interfermo because his corner even told him not to do that. Not that so much because they were worried Interfermo would overpower him, but because, like you said, Pat, like, he used...
Why do it?
Why do that? It was just not... That was his fight. You were going to suffer some kind of injury. It was going to be grueling from doing that. And if you can outbox him easily by doing that, why not just do that? And that's what Hagler was doing. And he cut Interfermo to ribbons early on. You know, like, Interfermo had Nick over here. He had Nick over here. This, there, that. His cornerman, his cutman, was the legendary Freddie Brown, a guy whose career went back decades upon decades upon decades. Most notably, as, you know, more modern fans most will probably remember him, or his association with Ray Arcel and Roberto Duran. But Freddie Brown had been around forever. And at one point during the fight, Freddie Brown apparently, as he was trying to work on Interfermo's cuts, he called on his assistant and said, "Help!" And I don't think you could do that today, right? That you could have two separate cut men working on cuts at the same time in a fight?
I mean, I haven't seen. I don't know. I've never seen that personally. I think you probably could. Like, if you had like a trainer and somebody who's supposed to be there, yeah, probably. But if just like calling somebody over, no.
Like that was a guy in the corner, but they said help, and they both were working on them. And
yeah, I don't think I've ever seen that. I mean,
Freddie Brown said
the fight would be stopped by then. Now, you know, like
Freddie Brown said afterwards, he was quoted. You said, "Man, I'm getting old." He was like, "In my prime, I could stop six cuts in under a minute and still have some time left over."
Which is nuts. I mean, and dude, we could do an entire podcast about like the art behind the cut man and shit like that. Fools were, I think, it to some degree they're allowed to make some shit now, but like I don't even know if they're allowed to, but back up into the fucking 70s and 80s, motherfuckers would literally have one of those little like doctor bags, one of the ones that, like, you know, like opens up, and it'd be like full of little fucking bottles, like
blue. All of their old boxes that they made up on their own.
Yeah. You'd pull out some shit. It's got like a fucking skull and crossbones on
and
it.
They were, and all
like,
treading them with each other too.
You'd like, fucking like pull out a cork and they're like, ugh.
I forgot which cut man I was reading about.
Wild.
They were saying that the cut man was saying I had this, and I had like all the normal stuff that you would have in a corner, plus some illegal stuff that's definitely not allowed anymore. And then the guy said, "I also had a couple of bottles of some special shit that I mixed up on my own of various things."
Dude, yeah, like I've seen some, like, yeah, a couple of interviews where fools are talking about, like, I got this powder, or I got this, and then I got like special liniments. I'm like, what the fuck are special liniments, bro? Anyway,
like Freddie Brown, as a lot of old school trainers, I'd love to know how they would hold up today in the rules today, but back then they were able to do their tricks, and to his credit, he was able to hold Interfermo's face up because of it. And it was a grueling fight. Hagler was outboxing him, but also too, the Interfermo's still coming. Eventually he has to stop and trade with him too, which he did and willingly did. But Interfermo was able to shade some of the later rounds because of that, because Hagler did slow down. This was his first title fight, and I think people even said that you could see that there was a little bit of nerves with Hagler there too, with just he was on the big stage for the first time like this and just everything. And as Interfermo came on strong in the later rounds, I guess, you know, it pushed the fight slightly closer, but again, it's still kind of like indefensible that he won that fight. And if you watch it too afterwards, when they announce it, they're like, Interfermo, you know, it's a draw. Then Interfermo's corner picks him up like he just won the world championship again, right? He's celebrating, he's raising his hands and all that. Hagler is dejected as shit. And you hear Cosell in the background, "It's a draw! Interfermo retains!" Like, he's almost saying it incredulously. Like, he's still kind of keeping the straight path, but you can see it and you can hear it in his voice where he's kind of surprised, like, holy shit. And the most glaring part of it And I don't know if this was actually true or not, but it's been written about, and it's been written about in various articles. Mills Lane, who was the referee, allegedly went up to Hagler after the fight and told him, hey, turn this way. Congratulations. You know, turn this way for the camera. So when I raise your hand, we can, like, you know, pose for this and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was reading that too. There's a really good Sports Illustrated article by Pat Putnam about the fight. I mean, yeah, dude, it really should have gone Hagler's way. It was close, but I think that I would probably agree. He probably fought a little bit harder than he should early on, and then maybe didn't have enough gas for later or something. Even so, I thought that he won. It should have been his fight by like a couple of points, but it was one of those fights where it seemed like close but clear. Like,
yes,
there didn't seem like there were some rounds where Enzo Firmo won for sure, but most of them were rounds where like Hagler was slowing down. When he was keeping pace, he was consistently landing harder, consistently landing cleaner. And on top of that, like even though he was mostly staying away from Enzo Firmo when he could, he still wound up cut like around his right eye and was bleeding pretty good for the last like third of the fight. And so, I mean, you know, it was still a pretty rough and tumble fight. And like I said, it was a good fight. In the last maybe 5-6 rounds of the fight, dude, it was entertaining. It was actually a pretty good slugfest at a couple points. But it was just that, when Enzo Firmo gets hit too, because of the way that he's leaning in, there were times where he was like, you know, like just totally like whipping around and shit like that. And because he's so off balance and he's like leaping in and whatnot, almost looking like Nassim Hamed when he gets hit, you know, just so exaggerated. So that probably didn't help either. But also you have to wonder, like the judges are right there and they're seeing that shit. It just seemed to me like if you're going to edge it either way, it would be to Hagler, but apparently not.
You know, I think is the most damning thing is that after the fight, Bob Arum and others were like saying that we need to have an immediate rematch. This was bullshit, yada, yada, yada. And Jose Suleiman, you know, just on brand for him in the WBC. We're not going to be intimidated and pushed around by any promoters. We're going to review the fight and then figure it out. But first, Alan Minter.
Who are you to tell us to do the right thing?
Yeah, right? Yeah. And so Hagler had to wait almost like over a year, almost a year for another title fight, because Alan Minter at that point was the mandatory challenger for the winner of that. And even though it was a draw, and by most accounts, like you would think there should have been an immediate rematch right after that between Hagler and DeFermo, and Minter should have just waited and get the winner of that again. No, Minter got the title fight. Minter beats DeFermo in a controversial fight, just about as controversial, and maybe not even as bad as Hagler, as the first Hagler fight. But Minter and DeFermo was controversial enough to warrant an immediate rematch. Interesting enough, right?
Well, and it went to show how the politics could work,
yes,
for somebody and against somebody else in seemingly totally equal situations, where you had the head of the WBA at the time, or the guy who was basically the behind the scenes action guy at the WBA, Elias Cordoba, basically, according to reports and according to like the Pat Putnam article, what happened was that Jose Suleiman said, no, we're not going to be issuing no immediate rematch. I don't know what you're talking about. You know, Alan Minter's been waiting in the wings and he's our number one challenger. So, you know, they got to wait for Minter and Enzo Firmo to figure this shit out now. But then Elias Cordoba said, yeah, you know, that sounds about right. We'll go with that. But then according to Pat Putnam, he had a meeting with Bob Arum, and then after the meeting said, nah, we changed our mind, actually. We think we should order an immediate rematch. And so it placed Enzo Firmo in a position where, regardless of who he fought, they were threatening some sort of action against him from, and on top of that, we've talked about this before, a couple years before this, so was around 1975, 76, 77, was that prolonged splitting of the WBA and WBC, where they're feuding and shit like that and refusing to recognize each other and whatnot. And so on top of that, here's another situation where they're at odds and placing the fighters in a shitty situation. And Marvin Hagler, regardless, has just having to fucking sit.
And it's ridiculous because, like you said, it was the same circumstance, basically. Hagler had a controversial fight with Interfermo, and Interfermo has a controversial fight with Minter. I think the main gripe with that one was that there was a judge from the UK that basically scored almost every round for Minter when it clearly shouldn't have been that way. And it made it look like there was a weird bias, and so they ordered an immediate rematch. They have a rematch, Minter chops him up and stops, you know, Interfermo confirming everything, but... Yeah, it's funky that Hagler couldn't get an immediate rematch, but Interfermo was able to get one with Minter. Regardless,
Hagler was that UK judge? Was that UK judge Adelaide Bird?
Yeah. You can either confirm or deny. But, you know, it's just kind of sad that it took Hagler another year before he was finally able to get that championship. And then, on brand for Hagler, and the whole time he struggled his entire career trying to get to that point, he couldn't even celebrate that win because of the racist assholes in the arena that day throwing beer cans at him and his entourage. So,
yeah, dude, so fucked up. Fucking Minter said something to the effect of never let a black man take the title or hold the title or something like that. And I mean, it just wound up being somewhat, well, bandwagon, racist fucking bandwagon after he cuts Minter up and beats the crap out of him. For whatever it was, two rounds, they pelt him with fucking beer bottles and beer cans.
He goes on his knees, he's celebrating, he's finally going to become champion. He couldn't even get the belt put around him, anything like that.
Yeah, they got to whisk him away undercover.
And someone said too, I think it was in the book. It was in the book that that Kimball wrote, The Four Kings.
Four Kings.
He said that it was either he witnessed this or someone else did, that they knew there was going to be trouble. That they were selling beer by the case that night, like over there, and they said they were watching like skinheads walking up the ramp, rocking up the rafters with like holding double cases of beer walking up there. Like, and they were just like, and the guy was looking, they're just like, oh, well, that doesn't look good.
It's like having free bat night at Dodger Stadium along with quarter beer night or something. You know what I mean? It's like, what the fuck are you doing, bro? But I mean, regardless, that doesn't excuse anything. It was fucking awful and it was stupid what they did, and it fucked and it just I think, you know, going back to how we started, it probably further fueled this distrust and hatred and frustration from Hagler. Dude, he lost his first fucking middleweight title challenge. Didn't get the title. I mean, to him it might as well have been a loss, I think. Draw, who gives a fuck? You know what I mean? I would have been pissed too. And so that, I think, just further placed him in a position where he was like, what the fuck am I trusting anybody for? The Petronellis are who got me to this point and who got me to the title eventually. You know, who the fuck am I putting my faith in? Yeah. So I think you have to kind of understand in that context when we go back and start talking about Leonard and Benitez, because obviously Hagler and Leonard eventually meet.
Absolutely. And so that's what builds to this main event now, is that like, it's the polar opposite of what we've just come into. Hagler and Interfermo, two guys, hard scrappers that had
to do. Sorry to interrupt you too, but on one of the broadcasts, you could see Ray Leonard. He's not even fucking suited up, nothing, just sitting ringside watching Hagler.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I wonder too, I don't think he was thinking at that point too that eventually those two were going to fight. He was just watching it as an observer.
It's just fucking wild.
He was like a Hagler fan. He was happy to, you know, kind of thought that Hagler was job too. You know, it's crazy.
Just wild.
It really is, you know, considering that, 8 years later, they finally get it on. But, you know, the main event, man, it's polar opposites of the two guys that we were just talking about. You got Sugar Ray Leonard, the darling of the 1976 Olympic team, against Wilfred Benitez, the genius, the boy prodigy. Well, you know, so many different words you can use for Benitez and his skill level that at that point, no one had ever seen someone that young do the things they was able to do. He was a fucking wizard in the ring, bro, like an absolute wizard. And you were going to put those two in together to, you know, for the welterweight championship. You couldn't get any better than that. So again, you got to go back to the beginning of the 70s really quick. Who was the dominant champion of that decade? Jose Napoles. You know what I mean? After he knocked off Curtis Cox, he was the resident champion and a great, great champion at that. One of the greatest welterweights who ever lived, man. His blend of speed and skill, everything there was unparalleled. By the time he loses the championship though in 1975 to a very good fighter by the name of John Stracy from England, The welterweight division is kind of, you know, in a turnstile again, because like Monzon, you had a guy that was the dominant champion for so long, and all of a sudden, when he either retires or loses, it puts the division in a tailspin momentarily until you get a guy who's going to be like, you know, hold the momentum again. So Stracy was a good fighter and a good champion, but clearly he didn't have the stuff to be a long reigning champion, because after he made a couple of defenses, including one against Hedgeman Lewis, he ends up losing to the very popular and a good fighter in himself, Carlos Palomino. Over at the on the WBA side, you know, that title's being switched around like hot potatoes until a guy by the name of Angel Espada becomes champion. And pretty soon, before he knows it, he runs into a precocious teenager himself by the name of Pepino Cuevas. And Cuevas, you know, shockingly, who had a mediocre record himself and wasn't really looked upon as anything special, knocks the shit out of Espada and becomes champion. So now you got you got Pepino Cuevas as champion. You got Carlos Palomino as champion. Both of those guys are very, very good fighters, and they're looked upon maybe as eventually moving on themselves as like a potential super fight. Benitez at this point is down at junior welterweight. He had just beaten the legendary Antonio Cervantes for the championship, but there was already kind of questions arising about his dedication and the things going on with him and yada, yada, yada. You know what I mean? Sugar Ray Leonard was already building himself at this point too. He had, at the 76 Olympics, he had just turned pro and he was still building himself up. So he wasn't quite at that point. Everything was still coming to a head. Benitez eventually moves up, fights Palomino, in 1979, I think it was, and scores a razor thin decision over him, becomes champion, right? Over on the welterweight side, Pepino Cuevas is still champion and he's still dominating everything like that. But like Leonard, you know, there's like, as Leonard is about to become, you know, as building up to become number one, there's the question now, is he going to fight Pepino Cuevas, which would look like it might be happening, or is he going to fight Wilfred Benitez? Now it's going to end up happening. He's going to fight Benitez. Or obviously that's like the more, I would say the fight for the fans, that would be the fight that everyone might be more clamoring for, because the contrast, the styles, the everything like that, you can't get any bigger than that. If you put this in 2022 today, dude, that's like as big as it gets. Like these dudes,
yeah,
you can't beat that.
Benitez is 21 and also undefeated.
Yeah.
He's had a draw, but he's undefeated. And I think the draw, I want to say, was against Weston in a pretty good fight.
It was Weston or Bruce Curry. No, I think it was Weston, because he beat Curry by like bullshit decision. That's right.
And so he's undefeated and he's only 21 years old. He almost has 40 fights under his belt, 21 years old. Now, I mean, that's kind of its own issue though. That's its own story, because Wilfred Benitez, who's actually born in New York, believe it or not, he was actually grew up for a little bit in, I want to say, South Bronx. He and his brothers, when they were little, started getting into trouble on the streets. And his father, Gregorio, he was the youngest of four brothers. Gregorio, their dad, moves them to Puerto Rico, kind of the outskirts of San Juan, and starts training them all. Mm-hmm. And Wilfred basically showed, I guess, the most talent, but all of the brothers were fighters. And so starting from a really young age, he turned pro actually at, I think, 15 years old, because Gregorio had falsified records to get him to turn pro. What's that?
Said you don't say.
Yeah, dude. I mean, and that's its own. Whew. Yeah, bro. The daddy issues there run deep, real deep. But, you know, it's 16 years old. Wilfred Benitez is headlining at the Felt Forum, which was like kind of like the old school Madison Square Garden theater. And it's 16 years old. So already he was on the way to kind of stardom and becomes the youngest world champion ever at 17 years old. And so already you're kind of seeing, you know, the groundwork being laid for a pretty big issue. As soon as he wins the championship, and like you said, there's already been a lot of talk about him just not liking to train, not wanting to train, fucking around, getting into trouble. And his dad pens an article for The Ring that says essentially the reasons why my son will lose the championship or something like that, you know. And it's like, Holy fuck, dude. Imagine, like, you know, you have some massive accomplishment and one of your parents goes on to social media and is like, this is why this accomplishment means nothing. Like, you'd feel like shit, you know, absolute shit. And so, in any case, this
one. It's crazy to think, man, because Benitez was so gifted. You watch his fights back then, and he was one of those guys, like, he never held his hands, like, right up there. Like, he always kind of held them, like, over here. And he just had these instincts, bro. Like, just the way he would boop, 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 boop. You couldn't catch him. And
he lost some of his biggest fights. And then also on top of that, with all due respect to him, the way that he wound up, it's almost like he still doesn't get, like, you know, people talk about Nicolino Loche, understandably. They talk about Willie Pep, understandably. Purnell, understandably. All these great defensive masters, dude. I'm just saying, don't sleep on Wilfred Benitez.
You can't. Benitez was an absolute genius. Just a genius, man. And, I mean, no one, look, there's nobody in history, I don't think, that will ever able to replicate a 17-year-old beating Antonio Cervantes for the world championship. That is insane.
Yeah, like, he wasn't just some scrub.
No. You know, there was almost like a joke. It wasn't really a joke as much as it was like a thing that people became, that they had to, if you said Antonio Cervantes' name, you had to put the legendary behind ahead of it. Like, he wasn't a bum. Cervantes was the man of the junior welterweight division. After he beat Loche, you know, from the early 70s, when from his loss to Benitez up until he finally lost to Aaron Pryor in 1980, Cervantes was the man of that division. No one was touching that dude. All right? He was a beast. And legitimately still one of the top five greatest junior welterweights that ever lived, right? Benitez beat him at 17. That doesn't, you know, like, I'm talking Michael Jordan, who plays basketball, Tony Williams, who plays drums. Certain people are just born to do certain things. Benitez was born to box. Like, that's a level of IQ that most people will never able to, like, you know, ever achieve something like that.
Yeah, dude, it's something it's one of those kinds of records that will just be so incredibly difficult to beat. And it's like, also, well, on some level, too,
because at 17 you can't be like, I don't even think you're allowed to fight for a world title.
Well, that's 17. and that's what I'm saying, is that, like, on some level, like, do you want that record be like, I don't put any fucking 16-year-olds in there. What are you talking about? Remember who was it the other day, that little kid the other day
that was posted up, yeah, that got beat up in Mexico, that poor kid.
God damn it, dude. Yeah, we don't want this to happen. But I mean, but that's what I'm talking about, though. So going into this Ray Leonard fight, dude, you know, Wilfred Benitez was a seasoned veteran at 21 years old. He knew what the fuck he was doing. And you know, on the flip side, Ray Leonard, I mean, it's not like he was without experience. No, he wasn't inexperienced, but just there was a pretty big gap in professional experience there.
It's true. You know, Leonard was him. He came up great early on. I'm not even going to try to lie about that. Like, his career, if you want to, when he turned pro from the 76 Olympics, there was a thing in Ring Magazine years ago where they compared him and Ali's opponents early on. And Leonard's clearly trumped Ali's. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because Ali fought some dirtbags fucking early on.
He absolutely did. But, like, by the time 1978, you know, Leonard was already fighting guys like, you know, if you look at 77, 27-3, 21-11.
Like, ranked dudes.
Absolutely. By 1978, when he fights Al Heyman's brother, Bobby Heyman, for instance, who people would be like, oh, Al Heyman had a brother who boxed. Yes, he did. And, you know, Bobby Heyman wasn't a contender or anything like that, but he was a guy that was around the block for a long time. That's when he started fighting dudes left and right. Like, he moves on. He fought Mickey Ward's half-brother, Dick Eklund. He fights Floyd Mayweather Sr. He fights the very, very tough Randy Shields, who was a pain in the ass for everybody in the welterweight division from the 70s up until the early 80s, and doesn't get talked about enough. Very good contender. Armando Muniz, longtime contender, who from losing to Emil Griffith early on in his career to giving Carlos Palomino absolute hell in their welterweight title fight, to giving Jose Napoles. Like, that's how far he went back. He even went back to fight in Napoles. Like, Armando Muniz was just one of those longtime contenders that fought a who's who of everybody in the 70s. And by the time he fought Leonard, would have given Leonard, you know, a hell of a fight, but Leonard was able to blast him out too. You know, like, this was this competition as Leonard was coming up with. you know, a lot of these dudes today, when they're built up, they fight guys with inflated records. They fight journeymen. They fight guys way past their best. You know, they're not actually being matchmaked to like really like gain experience to that degree. Some, I mean, there's some people out there like Top Rank. We like to give them shit sometimes for some of their antics, but they have great Hall of Fame matchmakers that know how to build their prospects. Other, you know, other people like Golden Boy, some, you know, to a degree, same as well. And Leonard was built up well. You can't say that, even though he had like, it looked like he might have an inflated record. Look at the guys he's fighting. You know what I mean? Like you go from Armando Muniz to Johnny Gant, who was a longtime fringe contender, fought a who's who. Fernand Marquette, another guy from Canada, who had a longtime career from the 60s up until then, fought a who's who, and a really rugged individual who didn't get knocked out by many people, and Leonard blasted him. So, by the, and Adolfo Virouet as well.
I mean, yeah, Edwin Virouet's brother.
Yes, bro.
Both very good fighters.
Bad motherfuckers, man. Marcos Giraldo. And Marcos Giraldo was the one that actually, like, got people concerned about Leonard, because Giraldo was a rugged, big, tough, rugged individual who fought everybody back in the day. Mexican middleweight, you know, which is kind of an anomaly in itself. But he went the distance with Hagler. He gave shit to Leonard, where Leonard had a damaged eye and everything like that. And Mike Trainer, Leonard's manager, and always protective over Leonard, and very a genius in itself too, because he was the guy that made sure Leonard never actually like hooked up with a promoter, anyone who bid on the most money, you know, like he was a great manager. But if you read Leonard's book, if you read other accounts, he got freaked out after this fight because Leonard took a lot of punishment in that fight. Giraldo was a bad motherfucker, and he was bigger than Leonard, and he gave Leonard the business that fight. And Leonard was puffed up, and his eyes were a little damaged and all that. And Mike Trainor almost wanted Leonard to retire. He was like scared. He was like, I don't want you taking this type of punishment. And anyways, you know, that was the type of guy Giraldo was. Didn't have a great record, but he was just a rugged, bad motherfucker. Pete Ranzani. And so by the time he's about to fight Wilfred Benitez, his last fight before that was against Andy Price. Andy Price at that point.
Poor Andy Price.
Poor Andy Price, right? Andy the Hawk
Price. Seemed like such a nice guy.
Seriously. You know, a rugged contender, had been around the block for a long time, deserved the title shot probably, and he at that point was the only person who had beat both Carlos Palomino and Pepino Cuevas. And so a lot of people were calling him at that point the uncrowned champion before Benitez beat Palomino and before Leonard ascended. And they were saying he deserves the title shot, yada, yada, yada. He's also managed by Marvin Gaye. Keep that in mind really quick. So, you know, Andy Price is the NABF champion. I know he felt a little like overconfident. He thought Leonard was a pretty boy and thought he could, like, you know, with his experience, he could beat him. And Marvin Gaye, before the fight, I believe he bet all of his money on Andy Price on a win. I'm talking not just money like that he had on him. I'm talking like his whole fortune on an Andy Price win. And what happened, Pat?
Andy Price got absolutely slaughtered, dude. Like, I mean, it was like, bah, 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 and he just, like, you know, it was like, remember that video from a couple years ago where Fool was just playing the motherfucking like drums on dude's head in the subway? Like, yes. He's like, dah, 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 bah, 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 you know, like 50 times in like 3 seconds. Okay, it wasn't that quite that many with Andy Price, but yeah, he just got blasted real bad. And I think that this was kind of one of those instances, or at least one of the earlier instances, where it didn't always happen, but it happened frequently, where if you fucked around and pissed Ray Leonard off,
yes,
like it brought out a real mean side of him. 'Cause like he was a cruel fighter. Like he was not a fighter that was like going to let you slide. And especially if you were talking shit. And I mean, yeah, dude, he was pretty, except for that gap in his teeth, which he got fixed later because fools were probably fucking with him about it. And so, but he was the type of dude that was like, he didn't take that shit lightly. He took it to heart, and then he was going to whoop your ass for it. And usually that's what happened. Usually he did. And so, you know, he knew Price was talking shit, calling him a pretty boy. He thought that he was going to be able to whoop his ass. He had a lot more experience too. Andy Price was really experienced. He got fucking blasted. And like I said, poor Andy Price, because it's like, it's almost like sad. Like, you know, the dude just gets totally overwhelmed. He didn't have a chance.
No, and you watch the fight, and like at first they're like Leonard's probing, he's probing, but you see the intensity in his eyes. And Price landed a counter or two, but he's like, they're just kind of like they're probing each other, they're still feeling each other out. But like you said, man, that might have been the first time people really saw the true like eye of the tiger with Leonard, because once Price got on the ropes,
Yeah, he backs to the ropes and Ray's just like, mine.
yeah. Ray, like, Price starts freezing up a little bit, and Ray just, jabbing. And then at one point, he lands that right hand. Price freezes up a little bit, and then Ray just unloads. He lands a body shot and then just go crazy.
Oh.
And the
Yeah,
way, like,
brutal.
Price's head, you see Price's head, like, going in various directions. And then finally, as he goes down in an absolute heap. And he looks like a fucking deer that was just born and doesn't know how to use their legs yet, you know?
Yeah, it was bad, dude. And so you could see, it I think probably brought some belief back or some spark back, into the idea that, okay, all right, I think we're all right. I think we're okay with this Leonard kid. I think he'll be all right.
And so
And
that was like catapulted them to the Benitez fight.
well, and those were back in the days too, where that Andy Price fight was 2 months before the Benitez fight. And now, if that happened now, people would be like, oh my God, he fought 2 months ago. Oh my God. Now you couldn't even have, that shit wouldn't happen. But it I think led a lot of people to, well, look, looking right there on the record, dude. He gets Marcos Giraldo, and then 3 months later he's in with Ranzani, and then like a little over a month later, it's Andy Price. So obviously
Nine
he's
fights in 1979.
dude
Nine
that
fights in 1979.
well, and his pace obviously slowed a lot after that. But even so, that's a lot of experience jam-packed into a pretty short period of time, and probably contributed to his eye issues too. But even so, and I mean, dude, by this time, I think he'd already like threatened retirement once or twice too already. So I mean,
He wasn't even supposed to turn pro.
that's true. Yeah, he threatened to retire from boxing entirely after he won the gold.
He
So
said I wasn't even gonna turn pro, so I'd be like, what do you want?
Thankfully, that wasn't the case, because he turned out to be obviously a really, really, really good fighter. But he packed a lot of experience into this short period of time, and especially in those couple of fights leading up to the Benitez fight. So I mean, it makes sense, knowing that you have this contrast of styles. Okay, we have this newly awakened Ray Leonard that's blasting motherfuckers, and then we have Wilfred Benitez, who is a defensive master. Let's pit these two against each other, dude.
And bro, it was a beautiful fight.
And the
Like,
stare down.
that's the first thing that has to be mentioned for that. So Benitez is, as we found out, was like notorious for that because he did it with Hearns a few years later. But that stare down was the stuff of legends. I still say today that's the greatest stare down in boxing history. And I
Just
mean, as
wake
weird as
you up
it
out of
is
a
to say that,
fucking
like
dead
makes you
sleep,
sound like a,
dude.
yeah, it makes you seem like a weird hardcore fan that you can like judge stare downs, but nothing will ever compare to that, because the minute both of those dudes got in the ring, Benitez, who was a little bit shorter, just gets right up in Leonard's chest and starts. And Sugar Ray's staring right back down at him too. And this was before even the judge, like before the referee was giving them instructions. Like they just straight up, both of them had huge egos, huge. And both of them undefeated. Benitez feeling as the champion, Leonard's beneath him. Leonard feeling this is gonna be a chance in the coronation. I'm gonna let this guy intimidate me. And they're right here. Like you see, like literally nose to nose. They could kiss each other if they wanted to. And they're just staring, and neither one of them will budge. Incredible.
Dude, it's easily one of the best, and the Hearns stare down's real good too, don't get me wrong. But yeah, just the intensity, and it goes on for like uncomfortably long, like where you're sitting there like, are they gonna break the stare? No? Okay.
Well, they
Oh
did it.
shit.
They no, their cornermen were the ones who had to break it apart.
Yeah, they peel Ray Leonard away, and Benitez is still trying to like, he's like, nope, not moving. And they're like, come on, dude, come on. Finally he goes around. But it wound up being such a closely matched fight for so much of it that like not until basically the final moments does one really gain a foothold, because it was so, I mean, it's almost, I think to a lot of people it would be not enjoyable to watch. It's fought on a high enough level that it's not awful or anything like that, But it's, if you don't like that kind of stylistic matchup, Leonard did not come aggressively at him like, you know, like the Price fight or something. He totally respected the fact that Wilfred Benitez is who he is. And I think that he tried to, like, he tried to get shit going in a number of rounds, but it was like he would try and then Benitez would be like, whoop, 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 whoop. And Leonard would be like, all right, all right, all right, let's calm down. You know, because it was like, you can't get him like that, you know?
Dude, even if Benitez was hurt, you showed it in the Hearns fight. Like, you know, if Benitez just had that type of, like, wired and system inside of him that even if he was hurt and, like, you know, he was a little vulnerable, he was still going to make you miss with multiple punches because that was just how he was wired. And if you threw a multiple, if you threw, like, a 10-punch flurry at him, chances are you'd miss about 7 of them. It's just, that's just the way he was.
Yeah, if not more, yeah.
So Leonard had to take his time with that. You couldn't go in there and get wild with him because all you're going to do is waste your energy, and eventually Benitez will start picking you apart from there because, like, you know, you're just getting wild, and he was a natural counterpuncher. That's what he did. But Leonard had such a great boxing brain himself. He knew how to work with it. And like you said, it wasn't the most exciting fight, but it was brilliant and very just intense in the way you're watching each guy. It's like playing chess, and that's the way boxing's supposed to be too, man. It's not just too, like, as much as I can enjoy Gotti Award or Bobby Chacon,
yeah, of course,
Luca Lamon for, you know, beating the shit out of each other, like, I'd love to watch two guys, as long as it's not that, as long as they're throwing punches, you know, trying to outfeign each other, trying to outcounter each other. You clearly see they're playing chess and trying to work, and that's what Leonard and Benitez was doing. Benitez is a natural thinker. The guy's Bobby Fischer in the ring. You know, he doesn't have to think that much because a guy like Benitez, everything came so naturally to him that he didn't even have to, like, use his mind, that, like, he just knew what he was doing. And that made it on his opponent, even a person as brilliant as Leonard, to make them think even more because they knew they were dealing with a person of equal brilliance, if not even more so than them. Because that was just what they naturally did. So you have to, like, calm down. You can't just go in there and wade in. You have to, like, pick your spots. It might not be the most exciting thing, but fuck it. You got to make sure you're going to win this fight because you're dealing with a guy with the equal brilliance of you. Like, that's what makes this fight so fucking perfect, is because you had guys with their boxing brains of that acumen, of that level, trying to outthink each other, trying to outfeign each other, trying to out, like, fight each other. It's brilliant stuff, man. And if Lennon wasn't at his peak, Benitez, apparently, according to him and his dad, he only trained for 2 weeks for that fight. Probably 1-1 still.
Yeah, dude. And I mean, I guess it's tough to know what Benitez's, like, true potential could have been, because throughout his career, they said that even since he was a fairly, you know, young teenager, like 16 or so, that his dad was well aware that he was fucking around too much. And it makes sense, dude. His dad literally used to, Gregorio Benitez used to charge people a quarter at the playground to watch his children fight.
I didn't even know that. Interesting.
So by the time you get to your, like, you know, 16 years old, you're probably sick of that shit, dude. And so clearly Wilfred Benitez had started fucking around already by that point. I'm not trying to make excuses for the guy.
Probably that
just
too.
Is what it is.
Piece of shit too, wasn't he?
What's that?
The Gregorio is a piece of shit too himself. Like, I know.
Well, let's put it this way, dude. I mean, and we know what boxing is at this point. So I guess at some point we have to kind of examine ourselves. But at the same time, Gregorio had 4 sons, and to my knowledge, at least 3 of the 4, if not all 4, because 3 of the 4 turned pro, and all three of them, I think it was the oldest who did not, and all 3 of them wound up with pugilistic dementia, Wilfred the most severe, and I believe it was the oldest one. He didn't turn pro or only fought like a couple times and had to retire or something like that. And the reason why was Gregorio had given some funky excuse about something, but a lot of people suspected the real reason why was that he also had pugilistic dementia at a really young age. So in any case, 3 out of 4 minimum sons that he totally ruined, you know, by the time they were fairly young and they were shot. And so, yeah, I would say that that qualifies as kind of a piece of shit. And on top of that, like I said, the Ring magazine article, he was constantly talking shit on his son.
And he was a gambler too. Like, he would take
yes.
the purse.
And also, yes. Yeah. He was a horse. He bet on horses, I think it was.
He was horses, yes. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah, not cool. Not fucking cool. So, yeah. But I mean, you know, this could have been potentially Wilfred Benitez, a big triumph for him, defeating Ray Leonard, an undefeated Ray Leonard. I mean, yeah, obviously it could have been written off. Ray Leonard was young. He was fairly young in his career. And if he suffered a loss, so fucking what? You know, it's not the end of the world. But the training, for sure. Excuses? Nah, man, it just is what it was. He was fucking around from a pretty young age. And had he reached, you know, a higher potential, who knows, man? Who knows?
So, let me ask you this, Pat. Do you consider him the fifth king, even though he didn't fight Hagler?
I mean, yeah, dude. I think that's kind of a technicality. I think Hagler would have defeated him. I don't think there's any question about that.
You think, though, he's not the fifth king because he didn't get a chance to fight Hagler?
No, I think it's fair to call him the fifth king, dude. I mean, as much as he accomplished, like, it's almost kind of, like, unfair.
And not only that, too, he fought Hearns. He fought Leonard.
And fought them almost on even, on like basically on even terms too. It wasn't like
I would almost consider him like, you know how with the Champions Forever video you have
like Norton. We talked about that before.
You have Norton and Holmes. All right, and so you have Norton, Holmes, Ali, and Frazier. Who did Holmes fought Norton. He fought Ali. He didn't fight Frazier. He didn't fight Foreman. Like Benitez, him in that group. He fought Leonard, he fought Hearns, he fought Durant. He didn't end up fighting Hagler. You should put him, you know, if they had the same thing, you probably should have put him there too.
I think it's fair too. Yeah.
If he had Mustafa Hamsho and wasn't upset by him, he would have got that title shot against Hagler. So
yeah, and I mean he fought nearly even up, at least in the fights that he took nearer to his prime. He fought nearly even up with Hearns and Leonard. I mean
he did. He clearly lost to both of them, but I mean he gave them both fits and he whipped Duran in a beautiful one of my favorite performances.
So I mean it's yeah, I don't think that it's unfair at all, dude. Clearly a super great fighter, you know, one of the best Puerto Rican fighters ever, without question. And I mean yeah, dude, to kind of ignore his accomplishments, especially among the guys who are, yeah, dude, it sucks. And especially, and it's compounded by the fact that he's in such dire straits now.
I know, man. It's sad. Like, he was, when he got inducted into the Hall of Fame, he was still with it to a degree. I mean, he was, you know, suffering a little bit, but he got inducted, I want to say 1995, 1996, around that time, right?
Yeah, and, something like that.
Yeah. You know, like, there's photos, you know, it's in the magazine. They show photos of him. He's there with his mom. He's, like, looking at his ring, whatever. But he's with it. Like, he's able to, like, you know, converse with other people, sign autographs, do all that stuff. It's awful to see the condition that he's in today. You know, it's really, really tragic. Yeah. And to think that he's probably in better shape or, like, in better conditions than what he was a few years ago, is even still mind blowing because like he's, you know, it's bad and he's still young.
Yeah. His contemporaries, dude, like Hagler before he passed away was in great shape. Leonard's in great shape. Durand fell out of good shape for a while, but now he's in good shape, you know, pretty good shape. Mm-hmm. And all of them spoke very well, very clearly. We're doing fine. And so, I mean, you look at his contemporaries and then you look at him. I mean, I think that you can definitely see what went wrong in the formula for sure.
I think it was because he was taking punches from grown men at the age of 16 years old.
Yep. No, absolutely no question whatsoever. And in during years when fuck, dude, we're basically just making a case against boxing on the show. But during years when your brain's still developing. You know, your brain is not done growing yet. So suffering fucking concussions, mini concussions, not good, not super good. So whatever you're going to do it safely.
But still, man, like regardless of all that, this was like Benitez at this point in 79. Like if you can watch these things, he was just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And if, you know, like I know a lot of people say like different fights, so you bring up, you'd be like, oh, what's the fight you would want your students to watch if you're trying to teach them certain things? We get a lot of Tony McCallum, very, very valid. and other fights. And for whatever reason, I don't see a lot of people ever mention Leonard Benitez, but like, you got to watch it. It's incredible. It's just the contrast, the styles, the fainting, the different things. They're trying to outthink each other the entire fight. And Leonard is clearly high wired to the highest point where he's forced to try to do the best he can. And I feel for Benitez too, because the fight was stopped in the last round. And you think, okay,
he got fights his ass off.
And there was literally only 6 seconds left. Like, you didn't have to stop it at that point. He wasn't in dire straits where he was going to get knocked unconscious. You know?
Yeah, he would have been all right had they left it. But
yeah,
he fought his ass off in it. And Leonard, you got to give Leonard credit, dude, because this is one of his biggest victories. And I mean, this was a fight where he pulled it out of his ass. Like, I mean, it wasn't like he was on the verge of losing per se, but it was a fight where he needed that separation and he needed to kind of step it up when he did. And he did.
And tell me if you agree with this. I don't think it's talked about enough anymore, because it was his first title fight. Everybody brings up the Hagler fight, rightfully so. Everybody brings up the second Duran fight, you know, things like that. I don't hear enough talk about the, you know, his first win, you know, his first title win over Benitez. It's just like, it's confirmed that people talk about it sometimes, but like, in terms of just like, you know, being added to the same kind of like No Mas and such, it's not there. It never has.
No, I agree, dude. It's one of his biggest wins. Like, as far as like being no controversy or no weird nothing, it's just a win. And it was before you could talk about the training and all that type of stuff, but even so, Benitez was obviously still like, he had not really started to slide at this point. He was still looking good. And so, yeah, dude, I think that it's a really good win and underrated. Probably should be talked about more. That's why we talked about it today.
Absolutely, and that's why we're talking about it right now. So my question to you is, would you have paid the pay-per-view price for this today? If there was a doubleheader, how much do you think it would have gone for?
Man, that show would have been, they're trying to charge like $125 or something, dude. Guaranteed for HD too? Come on.
But these, for the doubleheader like this?
Shit.
It would at least be a hard thing to think, right?
Yeah, or they would have tried to pull some bullshit where like to like a dual site or, you know, something like that, or two different shows. I don't know, man.
I don't know, man. Because again, like, Hagler Interfirma could hold its own. And Leonard Benitez obviously is a super fight on its own. I would think if you're going to make a comparison today, right, I would say a close one would be, and I don't think it's on this level. I don't think it's on this level at all of what Leonard Benitez and Hagler Interfirma was. But if you want to make a comparison, think about something like when Mayweather fought Canelo and then Danny Garcia fought
that's a good one. Yeah, that's a good one. I was gonna go back a little bit. I think it was a little farther, yeah, like 10 years before that, but like, that's a good one. I was gonna say Morales Pacquiao and Arce Hussein.
Yes, yeah, totally.
Because I remember going into that and being like, oh shit, this is gonna be some good shit. And it was fucking, that was a fucking good ass pay-per-view. But yeah, like, it just doesn't really happen. And that was a fucking pay-per-view. So it's not like, you know.
I remember when, like, that was on the Floyd Canelo undercard, right?
Danny? Yeah. Because I remember.
It wasn't Chino. No, excuse me. It was Maidana, not Chino.
That shit was fucking good, dude.
No, not Maidana. Fuck, I just said Maidana. Excuse me. Matisse,
yeah, Garcia Matisse, and that shit was like, you know, top two fighters at 140 after.
Oh, that was a kinda big fight that people were clamoring for. So yeah, that was a good pay-per-view. But I guess if you want to make a slight comparison, that would be something similar to that, where like, you got the both fights where they're clearly, they can be their own thing, and then they stacked it to that. But like, Leonard Benitez and Hagler Interfirma would just never be on the same card today. I'm sorry, this is never ever.
Well, yeah. You know, promoters, networks and whatnot, they've figured out a way to maximize like the profits by pretending that these fights, and I mean, dude, everybody's fucking guilty, some more than others, but pretending that these fights, and we've talked about it before, that are just normal fights, like contender versus contender, because one guy might have a belt, but he's not the, or they're not the fucking champion. It's just two top fighters in a division. That's it. Not a super fight. But they treat it as if it's a super fight, and you know, this fucking Saturday, rah! You know, and it's, and so every fight's a super fight, and they figured out a way to maximize this shit. So they wouldn't put two fights like that on the same card because they'd be like, well, why make fans happy when we could just line our pockets? So, I mean, and it's not to say they weren't looking to line their pockets back then. It's just that I think they had more accountability to a lot more entities than they do now. But anyway, that's its old other fucking podcast. So yeah, I would pay the fee though, dude, because that's a good card.
I totally would too, man. That's definitely not a streamable card for me. I would actually willingly pay the money for that.
I'd pay money for that.
If not, I would try, if I wasn't working it, I would try to be actually, I would fly out for that, something like that, totally. Because that would be a good meetup for people, I think. Like, if it happened today in 2022, you know, everybody on boxing Twitter, or at least our friends, the people we're close with, would definitely want to be out for something like that. And it would be in one of those memorable affairs where, unlike Crawford and Spence, which didn't take place, if it was taking place like that, I think everyone would be convening there, and, you know, just, it would be a beautiful affair.
I don't know, man. You flying out to Nebraska for Crawford Avanesian or?
Definitely not, man. Nebraska in what, December? Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, I'm not trying to go to Nebraska in December, January, February, March, April, man. Just go through the calendar.
Anywhere where I just know it's cold and it doesn't really get warm, all right? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm good. Nah, dude, it was an incredible doubleheader, especially in retrospect, and one that nobody really ever talks about. I mean, and a big part of that is how anticlimactic Hagler-Anto-Firmo 1 ended. And even then, after that fight, a lot of people are calling Hagler the uncrowned champion. Who knows, dude? We never, at that point, nobody knew. Nobody knew that they were going to be meeting up years down the line. So it's a pretty underrated card for that reason as well.
Dude, it's one of those things that, like, if I could find a poster of it that would be affordable to me, I would love to own it and frame it. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet. So,
yeah,
but man. I mean, it's that's why we did the show today, though, because it was like, it's a very important anniversary. There's a lot of history involved with the players involved, with the fighters involved, and what happened subsequently, and how they got there, and what happened afterwards, and how their careers intertwined. So. That's why we're here, my friend.
You are that deal finder, though, dude. So I'm not counting you out in that one.
For shirts. Listen, yeah, well, there's one before we head off, there is one shirt I'm looking for, man. There is like the whole Caesar's Palace logo. It was even before Leonard became champion. And it says on the they had the Caesar's Palace thing, and it says Sugar Ray Leonard, NABF champion on the bottom of it. If I have one of those, I will retire from the shirt game.
Have you even seen any for sale ever, and you just couldn't get them, or you just
I saw one in a Ring magazine one time years ago, as like his brother was wearing it. Never seen it for sale,
dude. I've seen.
I have four shirts that are my holy grails that I've seen in magazines that I'm hoping and praying one day will pop up somewhere, or if I meet somebody and they say they have a huge collection of shit, but not yet.
Dude, and it's funny because I've been trying to find one of those fucking those old Ring posters that's like 120 years of heavyweight champions, like, you know, it's like the gold colored. Every so often they pop up, but usually in really shitty shape or like super overpriced. Because I'm looking at these motherfucking ads and it's like $4.95, bro. Don't do me like that, y'all. Come on, eBay. No, but it's a. No, it's a really cool event, dude, and I appreciate you. You know, there wasn't really all that much homework because we've watched these fights and we know a lot of these stories already, but still, a lot of fun, man. Thank you.
I had to talk about it. Absolutely, man. It's always a blast talking about that, and as always, if you listened, I hope you enjoyed it today.
Yeah, dude. I think if people are listening for history, they generally enjoy the history, so hopefully so. But if you did listen in, thank you. We do appreciate it. And whatever podcast apps you listen through, please subscribe and leave a rating. We appreciate that as well. And as when it comes to watching on YouTube, thank you. And subscribe to that too. Leave us a comment. Try to respond back. Social media wise, the Knuckles and Gloves podcast is on Facebook and Instagram, but also on that dying total piece of shit they call Twitter. So go and hook up with us there, but also individually we're there on the said dying piece of shit Twitter. That is not the person I'm about to name. Just in case there's any ambiguity, Eris, go find Eris on Twitter as Punch Zone Eris. Me, Patrick Connor, go find me there as Patrick M. Connor, and we'll talk to you soon. Eris, we will hook up, bro.
Be good, everyone.
Later, everybody.